Well, it's kitten season, and you know what that means? It means local animal shelters are going to have a lot of cats. June is Adopt a Shelter Cat Month, kind of in response to that. And it means that there's a lot of shelter kitties that are looking for a loving home, maybe your home. Some things to think about when you're introducing a new pet to your home is sort of our topic today. And Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today, once again, to talk with you. And Sandy, thanks for coming by again.
Hey, you're welcome. I hope we can get some people interested in getting out there and adopting a new kitty friend.
How do you choose a cat that's right for you?
Well, I think the success of adoption has really been linked to the amount of research and reading that an owner has done prior to adoption. This has been shown with some research that was done back a few years ago. And I think it's because if you adopt and add a species to your house and you don't know much about them, you may start off with the, you know, doing the wrong thing, like just opening the door and bringing the cat in, or not providing it with the right resources, or you know, maybe not having a cat, an animal that's compatible with your other pets. So the more homework you do, the better. But you know, I think I have to kind of put on my veterinarian hat for some of the things I want to talk about, and then my behaviorist slash veterinarian hat, because they're really kind of two different things. And from my veterinary standpoint, I would like to say that, you know, bringing a cat in, you need to think about, one, are you prepared for having an animal that you are going to be financially, you know, you need to be able to take care of it for, if it's a kitten, 15 to 20 years, okay?
Yeah.
Adult cats, you know, maybe not quite as long, and they are in need of homes as well. So be thinking about that. The other thing is, you know, are you prepared for dealing with any medical conditions? If you've already got a cat in your house, and I see this happen all the time, people will adopt a new cat, not have them checked out, and then we find out that that cat has ear mites, intestinal parasites, fleas, you know, other things.
Which now the new cat, the old cat has.
We've got to treat the whole herd. And then there's some really horrible diseases like feline leukemia and FIV that can be contagious within a household as well, that can shorten a cat's life and make predispose them to other diseases. So, you know, making sure that this new cat, before it is introduced to the rest of the family, even if it's not another cat, but a dog too, because ear mites are contagious from, and fleas, from cats to dogs. So we want to make sure that we get them as healthy as we can, and so that means letting them have their own little efficiency apartment with their litter box and their food and so on, and get them in to see a veterinarian ASAP.
So those are some of financial?
Yeah, financial and the medical care.
And medical.
Okay, yeah.
And then what about the psychological?
Psychological stuff. Well, you know, cats, although they can be very adaptable, some more than others, I think it's really important for owners to visit with the cat and not take the first cat that you see. I just went through this with my daughter a few months ago, and she was like just so set. She was moving into a new apartment that allowed cats. She just graduated from college. She wants to get a cat. And of course, mom, the vet, went traveling along. And a couple of the first ones we saw, besides maybe being a little sickly, were also pretty shy, not wanting to interact with her. And I want to see a cat that is going to come up and maybe headbutt you, show some interest, be playful. Those are the cats that are going to be able to adapt to change a little bit better. Not saying that a cat that's shy won't adapt, but it may not be the perfect home for a young 20-something that's got people coming and going, or having to bring the cat to my house and when she's going away. Yes, I'm now the grandma cat babysitter, but you know, it's a cat that's shy may do better in a quieter household without kids and be just a wonderful, suitable pet. But when we're introducing a cat, you know, doing it slowly, letting it get used to one room at a time, it could take, if you've got other cats at home, I call it kind of the dating program, mm-hmm. where we let them get used to each other's smells while the cat's in another room. We make sure that they get to see each other maybe just through the crack in the door and not have any bad experiences with each other, because once you get into a fight, it takes a lot more work to go back to having a harmonious household again. So keeping them separate, and it could be days, it could be weeks, and it sometimes can be months. And you may not have a cat that's going to get along with the other cat, so that's something you need to think about when you're having a multi-cat household. Am I able to live in a house divided with these cats because they're so unhappy with each other? But sometimes we can bring happiness to the cat, a multi-cat household, by just providing them with extra resources, multiple feeding stations, scratching posts, multiple litter boxes. Remember the rule of thumb? A litter box for every cat in the household plus one. So one cat, ideally two litter boxes, and so on. So you can do the math. Two cats, three litter boxes. So that's just something to think about before you bring them in. Do you have the ability to provide them with all of those things? So it's a lot to think about, but yeah, they are a wonderful pets, especially for working families. And you can be gone for the day and know that they're going to be happy and healthy, but they still need playtime and lots of attention.
You know, let's switch from cats to dogs for a minute, because what is it? June 26th, I think, is Take Your Dog to Work Day.
It is.
Tell us a little more about that.
Well, this is something that the Pet Sitters Association started many, many years ago. I think it's been 14 or 15 years, where they wanted to just, you know, let people know that sometimes having a pet in a work environment offers a source of maybe a little distraction, but also from a good standpoint, it makes everybody a little bit calmer. It kind of opens up lines of discussion between people because, you know, who wants to go and just talk to somebody in a cubicle, but when you can go and talk to them and there's a dog or a cat there, but, you know, in this case, it's taking your dog to work, it can sometimes make your work environment so much better. But there are a number of things you have to think about. Like when I look at my pets, they would probably not be welcomed in most work environments because they snore. They may bark at things. And, you know, they're just, you know, a little more, you know, less sit in your lap type thing. They want to be, you know, out and exploring. And so I think they would probably not be very happy being stuck in an office for a while. Obviously, your employer needs to make sure that they're all okay with this. But even as an employee that has an employer that says, yes, you may bring your dog to work, you make sure that you have everything with you for cleanup supplies and food and so on. And make sure that you have the opportunity to have an out. Your dog may not make it all day. Yeah. You may have to take your dog home. And if that's not going to be possible, it could be really stressful, not only for the pet, but for also everybody that works there. Some things we don't think about are, you know, having your dog vaccinated before you take them into a situation like that. If other people are bringing their pets and your dog isn't current on vaccines, that could potentially be a problem. And as well, rabies, of course, because of liability, we need to make sure that we've got that under control. Make sure you also have insurance. I'm not talking pet insurance. I'm talking your own liability insurance. Mm-hmm. If your dog suddenly, you know, does some damage to where you work or hurts somebody when you're there, maybe they're startled or something and something bad happens like a bite, you are going to be responsible for paying for medical expenses or damages. So make sure that your dog is covered on your insurance. And for most homeowners, that is something that is it can happen, but it depends on the breed of the dog. There are some insurance companies that do not insure certain breeds of dogs. So you have to be aware of that as well. Other things that we like to make sure that we think about is, you know, making sure that your dog is groomed and ready to be able to go into that kind of work environment, because we don't want a shedding dog. So it may take a little work on your part to get them in there as well.
There's an online packet that actually we have up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, a link to it. But it talks about how to...
Get your dog ready.
Get your dog ready.
Right. And, you know, and not all dogs can go. I mean, we'd love to think we can have every dog there, but some dogs that aren't dog social or maybe are shy around certain people. And it's just a matter of being smart, knowing your dog before you take them into that kind of environment.
I have not given the number here, so let me do that right now. You may have a question about introducing a pet, or maybe you may have a question about your pet's health. I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show, and certainly we'd love to hear from you. What do you, this time of year, is there anything you're seeing, is it more of than not in the hospital?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of things that we're seeing is, you know, just like in the human world, pet obesity is a huge problem. And now that the weather is nice, people are going out and spending more time with their dogs outside, and so one of the things we're seeing is more injuries, things like, you know, torn cruciates because now the dog has become a weekend warrior and they're carrying extra weight. So if you're contemplating suddenly going, taking your dog for a hike or someplace, make sure that they are physically prepared to be able to get out there and do that. We are kind of, tick season is still here, but starting to peter out, but flea season is on our way right now as well. And people that have not got their pet on heartworm preventative, shame on you. It is something that we are seeing here in this area. And it's, you know, you don't have to have, your pet who's even an indoor pet, you know, a dog in particular, dogs, they still go outside. And because it's spread by mosquitoes, it's important that every dog be on heartworm preventative.
So another good thing to remember, and we have callers online. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Denise in Houston, Minnesota. Hi, Denise. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I just have a comment. When you were talking about take your dog to work, just this morning on the news, I saw there is a high school in Minnesota that has two service dogs that work with staff members, and they've become so much a part of the school community that they have their pictures in the yearbook, just like all the other staff.
Oh, wonderful.
That's wonderful. And you know what? They are a calming influence, and it really does help people to open up. And that's why, you know, we see dogs going into nursing homes and hospitals. The vet school sponsors a program called Pet Pals, which is our hospital visitation service with pets. And it's just such wonderful volunteer work. Work not only for the pet's sake, but also the owners get so much out of the help that they can provide to people.
Oh.
Yeah, it really is. If you get a chance, maybe I can Facebook you the link.
I would love to see that.
Of the yearbook page with the dogs posing just like any other staff member.
Oh. I love that. Would you please, Denise? I really would appreciate it.
I would certainly do that. You too. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too. Thank you so much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. You know, there's a recent study that's been done on the influence Fox News has had in American politics. And at 1 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn and her guests will talk about whether the conservative network could be causing problems for Republicans. That's today at 1 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. Right now, talking your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Henry from Indiana up next. Henry, thanks for calling.
Oops.
I think we lost him. Sorry, Henry. Carolyn in Brookfield, we turn to you next, I think. Well, wait, let's hold on a second. Henry? No, we've certainly lost him.
Well, one of the things that Henry was saying is that he is a firm believer in adopting adult cats from shelters because they have kind of a set personality, and that is so true. You kind of can get a feel for it. But remember, some of these cats that are in shelter situations, they can be kind of shell-shocked. I mean, they may not be themselves, and so personality will often blossom once they're, you know, in a new home. But that's why they like to take them out of that, you know, the cage situation and put them in a visitation room so that you can get a better idea of what this cat's going to be like. And, you know, they also, I find that adult cats a lot of times can be less destructive than kittens. They're not, maybe is inclined to climb the curtains and get into trouble that way. And but they still need the same veterinary care, the supplies, and everything else that you're going to need for adopting a cat.
Now let's turn to Carolyn in Brookfield. Hi, Carolyn. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I adopted a cat, an adult cat, about 2 years ago. She was so friendly when I went to a shelter, and I just fell in love with her. But just in the last year, she started attacking me. It's usually a blitz attack. I might be walking by, and she just jumps out and grabs my leg and bites me. And I was sitting on the bed one time, and she just she got such a funny look in her eyes, and she started growling.
Wow!
And she just attacked my arm. You know, like she wanted to fight me or something.
Yeah.
Wow.
A few things come to mind. Number one, you always want to make sure that there's nothing physically wrong that can be causing your cat to either be in pain or just not quite themselves. So a good physical exam, head-to-toe physical exam, including an oral exam, and maybe even a little bit of blood work to make sure that there isn't something wrong, like the cat isn't hyperthyroid or something that can make them more agitated. And so that would be number one. The things that I heard that there were episodes where your cat would just kind of ambush you, the silent ambush, and attack your ankles and take off. And in those cases, often what we call that is play aggression. The cat kind of hides. We're a big mouse. We're walking down the hallway, and boom, the cat comes out and jumps on us and takes off. Often that type of behavior, the teeth and the claws may be guarded where they're not going to use them, but in some cases they still put their claws out, but it's all kind of part of the play behavior. And when we have a cat that's doing that, the best thing you can do is play with your cat. I mentioned this earlier, just because you have a cat that's indoors and you can leave them alone for, several hours a day, doesn't mean that they don't need play. So lots of interactive play with toys on strings and wands and so on, so that the cat gets tired out. And sometimes we even have to carry toys and things with us so that if we can anticipate that cat's going to be hiding under the bed and we walk in the room, it's going to ambush us, we can toss a little, catnip mouse or something towards them. And that may be enough to redirect them away from us. The other thing that I get concerned about, though, is the fact that when your cat got this look in its eyes and then started growling and attacked your arm, there's a very common problem that we see in cats that we give the name redirected aggression. Your cat may be upset with something else. Maybe it was sitting in the bedroom and it saw a dog walk by, or there may have been a stray cat outside that it heard. There may have been something, even a smell, that got it triggered. You walk into the room and sit down, and this cat's in an agitated state, and it can't be aggressive with the thing that it's upset about, so it redirects its aggression to you. I kind of equate this to, you have a bad day at work, and so instead of yelling at your boss, you go home and you're grumpy with your spouse. And so that you're redirecting your emotional state to somebody who's totally innocent. And these can be really tricky cases to take care of, because you have to be able to identify what the trigger is that makes your cat get upset like this. I've had things like the vacuum trigger a cat to be like this. I've had in family situations where they may be talking very animated or yelling at each other. That gets the cat agitated, and that can trigger it. I had one woman who lived with her husband, and whenever she would sneeze, the cat would get agitated with her and attack her. And so she would have to go in the bathroom when she felt a sneeze coming on. If not, the cat would just stalk her and go for her. Very weird. But you want to try to avoid situations that can trigger these aggressive situations. And this is where it may require the help of an animal behaviorist, somebody that can come to your home and actually see how your cat behaves in its home environment, and really take a thorough history and be able to come up with some suggestions. Because we know that about 60% of cat bite wounds can become seriously infected, and any wound, any cat bite, especially if you've got fragile or elderly skin, really needs to, you need to seek medical attention, because we don't want to see you in the hospital with a serious infection.
And how do we find a behaviorist?
Really good question. There's a group called AVSAB, American Veterinary Society for Animal Behavior. That would be one group that I would be looking up. And you can just Google them online, American Veterinary Society of for Animal Behavior. And the with them, they also have their the Technicians Behavior Association, and they're linked, their websites are linked. Talking to your veterinarian. If your veterinarian doesn't do or doesn't have a strong interest in behavior that they can help you, or somebody on staff like one of their technicians, then maybe they'll be able to recommend someone locally. And, you know, this is very different than a dog trainer, especially when you're working with cats. And so getting a referral from somebody that's in the know is going to be your best bet.
Carolyn, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Bob and Nina a chance to join us. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
What can we do for you?
Well, my main question is bloat in dogs.
Okay.
We recently lost a 6.5-year-old standard poodle, and we were aware of bloat issues, not with him, but, you know, the possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And since that time, we've become even more educated in the dangers of bloat and the severity and the quick onset. And one of the questions I had was attacking of the stomach. Is this something that you recommend? Is this something we were going to have it done when we have him neutered? We were going to have it done, but then our breeder said, well, don't do that. So we're kind of in the quandary of yes or no.
Yeah, I think when you have an at-risk dog, which is any of the real deep-chested, narrow-chested dogs like poodles, Irish setters, you know, a lot of the setter breeds and so on are built like that. It's not a bad idea to consider having that done at the time of spay-neuter.
And what is that?
It's called a gastropexy. It's where they tack the stomach down to the abdominal wall. It's not going to prevent the animal from bloating, meaning the stomach may still fill up with air, but it may prevent it from twisting, which is where it becomes really life-threatening, because you can compromise the blood supply to the intestinal tract and the stomach, and it can affect, you know, just blood flow up into the thorax. And that's why a lot of these animals that do bloat and tours just, you know, can have a very poor prognosis without you know, really good emergency care. So I think it's not a bad idea. We offer at the vet school a package that involves laparoscopic spay and gastropexy. For neutering, it's going to mean an extra surgery, and that's something to be considering, and that's maybe why the breeder was saying, don't consider doing it, because when you're neutering dogs, you're not entering the abdominal cavity like you are when we're doing either a spay or an ovariectomy. In female dogs, everything's done externally, so it's going to mean, you know, doing another procedure to be able to have it done on a boy dog, but I think it's not a bad idea. I think things that, you know, we know that there's, you know, a lot of ideas out there, like multiple smaller meals a day, minimum, you know, two would be ideal. Even watching how much water they take in. One of the last bloat cases I dealt with was a dog that had been exercising all day and went in and just drank a big, huge bowl of water. And then the owner left and left the toilet seat up, and it drank a ton of water. And it was just a water-filled stomach that actually caused the animal to bloat and tours. So, you know, watching after a lot of exercise, stressful events can sometimes bring this on. Some people claim like the fermentation issues with food. And so, you know, consider maybe, and again, I don't know if there's strong evidence for this, but going to a grain-free diet, you know, something that may be less fermentable, that may be helpful. There's been controversy as to whether an elevated food bowl will help or not. There's one study that says no, that actually predisposes dogs to bloat. And there's others that say, you know, yes, it helps. But, you know, I think, you know, there's lots of information out there and what's right and what isn't. But, the best way you can prevent it is by having that gastropexy done.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so sorry that you lost your dog. It's a horrible way for them to go.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Bob, for calling. Appreciate your call. Just as an aside, I'm going to mention that on our Facebook page, Denise, who had called earlier from Minnesota about the high school that has service dogs, and they have them in their yearbook, she sent a photo of the yearbook with one of the service dogs.
There we go. Yeah.
It's great. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and you can see that. And you can also, if you've got a pet photo, we always love to have them on our website. So you can go ahead and post them, too. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Dawn in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Dawn.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm just so confused. My friend was sending me information about heartworm and that dogs in Wisconsin, it's very hard for them to get a heartworm because the cycle for the mosquito, the parasite in the mosquito, is almost impossible to come to maturity.
Well, yeah, I beg to differ on that. And, you know, we do have some seasons where our heartworm season may be shorter, and we're definitely have a very different heartworm season than what we do, you know, in the southern states where it can be warmer longer. For heartworm to develop, it has to have a mosquito stage, and there's some larval stages, so a mosquito has to bite a dog, ingest blood that has some of the larvae or the immature stages, and they go through a molt phase inside the mosquito. And you do need fairly consistent temperatures above 57 degrees for that to happen. The big issue is that, you know, when do we have that kind of weather where we can have it be 57 degrees for the not only the mosquitoes to survive and develop, but for those larvae as well. And remember, we're not only, when we use heartworm preventative, using it to prevent heartworm disease, it also has other purposes as well. Probably the number one thing is for intestinal parasites. Not so much for the health of the dog, although yes, it's going to keep your dog healthier, but for public health risk as well. The main parasites that most of them get are going to be the ones that are zoonotic for us that we get concerned about. And some heartworm preventatives too, like if you look like something like Advantix, will also help control fleas, ear mites, scabies, you know, lots of different things like that as well. So there's a number of reasons why we use it. We are now, I mean, I've worked in Madison now since 1987, and I have to admit, 10 years ago, I would have said, you know, we just, most of the dogs that we see that have heartworm disease are going to be, you know, dogs that are imported from other parts of the country. And we're seeing a lot of dogs coming from down south that have heartworm and are now infecting our local mosquito population. But my last two heartworm positive dogs that I've dealt with just recently are both local Madison dogs that have never left this area, that the owner was just moderately inconsistent with using heartworm preventative, and they came back heartworm positive. And so that tells me that we have a reservoir of infected canids in our area. It may not be your next door neighbor's dog. It may be that coyote that is roaming in the woods behind your house. So I am a big believer in year-round heartworm control, regardless of where you live.
Even in the wintertime?
Even in the winter, because remember, we're using it for GI parasite control. And I can't tell you how often I know of people that even do something like travel down into central Illinois, where just crossing the state line can change the seasonality enough that it may predispose your dog to getting it. And remember, mosquitoes can survive in sheltered environments even once it's been frosted outside. So that's why if you are going to use it seasonally, we recommend using it till at least November, December. That pill you give prevents for the previous month. So in September, if you gave a pill, it's preventing for August. And December for November. So you always have to think backwards like that. So it's just so much easier to just do it year-round. It helps everybody. It helps your neighbors. It helps your dog. And you don't have to worry if you're traveling.
Okay.
Thanks, Dawn. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. On Facebook, we had a comment, and this is from an apartment dweller. He says, a neighboring unit in my apartment has three cats. She keeps in an efficiency apartment. She'll leave them outside for days and spends months out of state getting a friend to periodically check on their food and water levels. For a year now, a foul cat odor has been coming from the wall that her unit shares with ours. At which point do I get concerned about neglect?
Now.
Yeah, I would say right now.
I would say right now. I mean, especially if you're getting bad odors coming through there. Three cats in an efficiency apartment. Remember, cats can be rather territorial. And if it's just someone going in and checking on them periodically, they may not be getting their litter boxes changed. So that can be very stressful for the cat. Are they being, you know, cared for medically? I think, first of all, you know, talk it over with the next door neighbor. But if they're, you know, unwilling to help you, I think the landlord needs to be involved to be able to say, hey, something's going on here, even though pets may be allowed. You know, if they're not being cared for, and, you know, then going to animal control and just saying, would you please check on this? Because I'm, you know, we're worried about the health and safety of the cats that are in this apartment.
I'd go right to the apartment owner.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would. Because somebody who would leave their cats for months at a time and just have...
Yeah. They're not getting the mental stimulation, physical stimulation. They may not be getting adequate medical care. Or being fed on a regular schedule. And, you know, so who knows what's going on with them. And I really think it would be, if you are adopting a cat, just because they use a litter box and you can leave them alone, I will never have a cat unchecked at least once or twice a day. I think it's so important for somebody to go in and see. I've had owners leave and had someone come in like 48 hours later, not been able to find a cat, and believe it or not, found it locked in a dresser drawer. They were in a hurry to pack up. And if they had not come in to check on those cats and just left them with a bunch of food, that cat would have been stuck in that dresser drawer for the entire time the owner was gone. So weird things happen. And I think it's, you know, important to have somebody just check on their well-being.
I have someone come in now. We were just back from 9 days out of state, and I had somebody morning and night come in, feed the cats, check the litter, play with the kitties. And I can recall, and this goes back a ways, but I can recall our cats that are coming to check on the cats and not being able to find the cats, and they had locked themselves into somehow managed to shut the door and were locked into a room that didn't have their food or anything.
And I remember your pet sitter actually bringing one of your cats in on an emergency basis for a urinary tract issue. Now, that is a good pet sitter because they recognized that there was a health problem and took the opportunity to bring the cat to us.
Yeah, which was, I mean, we were in Hawaii. That was when we were on our Wisconsin Public Radio tour. And so it was such a relief to have someone with that kind of skill.
Right.
So there you go. Ingrid and Shano, thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Hi. We had a stray cat that took up residence between the neighbors and us. And we were very happy with it. He stayed at our house a couple of times, stayed at their house, you know, back and forth. Anyway, we ended up, my husband and I ended up moving 2.5 miles down the road. And occasionally they get us to cat sit for them when they take a trip. They kept him full time. And we were comfortable with that. That was his territory. So anyway, he does go outside. And when I cat sit for him, they bring him over here. He remembers us. He remembers the furniture. He remembers, you know, the things that we did with him. He remembers all of that. But I don't let him outside because this is unfamiliar territory for him. And I've tried using a leash and a harness on him, and he doesn't fight it, but he just lays down and won't move.
Yeah. Most cats, it does take training to use a leash and a harness, and you have them be comfortable with being able to walk on that with that type of device. A couple of things that you may want to look into, if this is going to be a recurrent thing, they do make kind of outdoor mesh kitty condos that would allow the cat to be able to get outside. Obviously, not run very far, but they're little kind of tubes that go run along the ground, so at least they can get some fresh air and look at the bugs and so on. The cat probably would be better off, you know, if unless it's on flea and tick prevention and heartworm prevention, better to stay in your house than to be outside, because even just going out on the grass is enough for them to be able to be exposed to different things. I just had a couple that I'm friends with that have four indoor cats that were outdoor cats. They moved out to the country, and they, you know, of obvious, just like this cat, showed up, and they spayed and neutered and vaccinated and brought these cats into their house. And they have actually rigged up a cat room with a window with a cat door in it and an outside screened-in porch that the cats have free access to, even in the winter. And it is an amazing thing. They've got, you know, like a tree branches in it and sitting areas for the cats, and yet they can't wander off. So,
yeah. The other question I would have, though, is having given up on the harness and the leash, what I've chosen to do for the day or two that I watch him is to leave him in the house. He's not happy about that. He gets frustrated. He gets angry. I can see that. And then eventually he gets mad and goes under the bed, or he starts yowling and walking through the house. And it's either because he wants to go outside or because it's an uncomfortable home and I can't figure out which it is.
Yeah, and you may find that even when you're babysitting, rather than letting him have the whole run of the house, giving him kind of a smaller area that he can be in, because that, even if it's intermittent, that may be a lot for him to suddenly go from, you know, one home to a whole different home. And
right.
Just let him get comfortable in maybe a spare bedroom or something. Make his little efficiency apartment in there.
Yeah.
Okay. Then just keep them isolated in that one room, so to speak, and give them food and water and cat litter and everything in there.
And lots of love. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks, Ingrid. Thanks a lot for calling. Good luck. And Steven, Steven's Point, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I have a cat that likes to wake us up at like 5 in the morning every morning.
Oh.
No particular reason. He's got food. He's got water. Clean litter boxes, and he meows for like a good hour or two every morning, and we can't get him to be quiet.
Welcome to my world. This morning it started at 4:45. And my alarm goes off at, you know, at 5 o'clock, and I had this cat that's just, I could hear her saying, "Melon, Melon." She loves to get a little cantaloupe ball every morning, as well as her canned food. And it's like, oh my goodness. But there's a reason for it. Two reasons. Number one, cats have, and I believe the correct term is crepuscular behavior, which means that they tend to be more active kind of at dusk and at dawn. And so, you know, that early in the morning, they're waking up, and they tend to be more active. And so you may want to look at either, you know, having some like a motorized toy or something that you can, you know, leave for the cat so that you don't have to be interacting with it. I ended up, I had this a few years ago. They called it the tiger toy. It was something that hung from the ceiling, and just the air currents of the room were enough to get this thing moving, and it would keep the cats busy and occupied. Sometimes we bring this behavior on ourselves because we get up and reward them. It may be us even yelling at them, but it got us to be up and interacting with the cat. And so it's, you know, trying to ignore the behavior and not reward it by getting up and feeding the cat, entertaining the cat, doing anything. And so, you know, what you'll find is that the behavior is going to increase with time. You're going to see the cat going, well, I meowed and they normally get out of bed. I'm going to have to meow louder to get them out of bed. Well, I'm going to have to become loud, you know, even louder and be more persistent to get them to pay attention to me. Eventually, the behavior will extinguish if the cat does not get rewarded for that. So, but it does take some time.
And I can remember Patricia McConnell saying sometimes right before the break, that's when they really will go at it and be noisy.
And that's exactly when we get up and go, all right, you know, I'll feed you. And then the cat's just like, oh, I've got to be obnoxious, really obnoxious to be able to get the human out of bed. So, yeah.
Thanks, Steve. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk for the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine today about your pet's health. And our lines are filled. The number is 1-800-642-1234. But you could also go to our Facebook page. just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and post your questions, comments, or even your pet photo right there. Love to hear from you. Ann in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ann. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I live alone, and I would love to get a pet, and I was thinking of a cat. But my sister and two different friends, all complain regularly because they don't get any sleep because their cat is up running around the house in the middle of the night or laying on their face while they're trying to sleep. And I said, well, why don't you just put the cat out of the bedroom? And they said, when we do, he scratches on the door and scratches on the door.
Yeah, and you know, and this is something that whenever you are bringing a new pet into your household, you need to be aware of, and this is where educating yourself before the cat comes in, you're going to be prepared for all of this. If you want the cat in your bedroom, start with it in your bedroom. If you don't want it in your bedroom, then that's how you start. The bedroom door is shut, and the cat is not allowed to come in the bedroom if it's meowing outside the door or being obnoxious. And you may have to resort to things like there's a product called Scat, which is compressed air with a motion sensor on it. You can put that in front of the door, and so when the cat comes up to try to get at the door to wake you up, it just gets a spray of air that's not going to bother you because it just makes a little hissing sound and it startles the cat, and they're like, okay, fine, don't go near the owner. The worst thing you can do is have the cat sit out there and meow, just like we talked about with the previous caller, and then open the door after it's been meowing for a while because it just got rewarded for being obnoxious with its meowing. Making sure that when you do get a cat, realize that they have high play needs, some more than others. We tend to find the cats with the big round heads and the longer hair coat, like Persians, may be a little more laid back and lazy. But if you get a cat that is kind of a lean, mean machine, they may be wanting to be playing a lot. And so if you're thinking, I'm just going to get a cat so it can sit on my lap and be company for me, think again. You may need to be playing with that cat for a half hour, a couple of times a day with the toys on strings and wands, things to keep the cat occupied. I ended up buying my daughter's cat because she was studying when she adopted her cat, and you know, senior in college, and oh my goodness, we've got this 7 or 8 month old cat that's driving her crazy. One of these toys that's called the Undercover Mouse, and it's a runs on batteries, and oh, it was so worth it because it's this mat on the ground with a little mouse that is on a wand, and it randomly goes in different directions, and the cat would spend hours chasing that and playing with that, and would leave her alone so she would have some time to study. But if she didn't do that, then she would have a cat that would do just this, sitting on her face at night, waking her up. And again, it's training the cat. Where do you want them to sleep? Just keep moving them to the end of the bed, and eventually they'll get that idea that they can sleep with you, but not on your face.
there you go. Thanks a lot, Ann, for calling. And Camille in Frankfort, Michigan, it's your turn. Hi, Camille.
Hi. My cat just turned 8 years old, and I've been feeding her dry food and wet food, the same kind, all these years, and she started throwing up the dry food. So I took her to the vet. He did blood work on her, and it came back negative. He said it's right down the middle. She's doing really well in everything we tested.
Good.
And then he gave me this prescription dry food to give her instead with the wet food.
Mm-hmm.
And she threw that up.
Okay.
But she seems to be able to hold down the wet food.
Okay.
So I'm wondering what else might we look at, or if I should just keep her on a diet of only wet food.
Well, it just concerns me that if she was not having issues with vomiting for all these years and all of a sudden this has started, your veterinarian was right on target. Rule out metabolic diseases like liver disease, hyperthyroidism, renal disease, anything that could be there that could be a problem. One thing that we sometimes discount is dental disease. And we'll see animals that have still like to eat dry food, but because their teeth are bad and they hurt, they swallow it whole, and so now instead of crunching it, they're down it's going, and it just may not be tolerated in the stomach. So that again would be something we'd want to be looking at, is does your cat have some underlying dental disease that could be driving this? Having a cat that vomits, we see vomiting with things like heart disease, heartworm disease in cats can result in a cat being a chronic vomiter. It may be something structural in the stomach or upper intestinal tract that's triggering this as well. Sometimes it may just be the texture of the food. Like, you know, I mentioned earlier, some cats are piggy cats and they wolf that food down and up it comes again, basically, you know, just maybe mixed with saliva. And if that's the case, if it's just like she's just being a little pig and just over consuming too quickly, spreading the food out into something like a muffin tin or one of these interactive cat feeders may be really helpful to slow her eating down. And I don't know what kind of therapeutic diet your veterinarian gave you. There's kind of a couple of things that I would try. One would be a low residue or a low and low fat diet, an intestinal tract diet, or whether they tried your cat on a hypoallergenic diet to rule out something like inflammatory bowel disease. That would be the other thing that we'd, you know, maybe be thinking of. And you can jump right next, if you've, you know, we've exhausted all of that, to taking some doing some imaging of the stomach to look for, you know, some kind of structural abnormality, which may involve giving a barium swallow, doing an abdominal ultrasound, to scoping and biopsying to look for another problem as well. So, you know, I just feeding your cat canned food, you're not finding out why it's vomiting, and that may end up leaving something that could potentially be fixed sooner rather than later.
There you go. Camille, thanks very much for calling. You can join in too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. John in Mason has a couple of questions that he sent, I think, through email, excuse me. One question was, why do dogs eat dirt? And, well, let's take that first.
Because it's there for the most part, okay? A lot of dogs just like to sample anything. Some of them will eat grass just because they like a salad. But whenever, if this is a brand new problem for the dog, they've never gone out and you know, eaten things like this before, then I'd be having them checked for intestinal parasites, something else would be causing GI upset. And we always get worried about foreign bodies. We've had dogs that eat rocks and gravel and end up with GI obstruction. So you have to be really careful with it. And because parasites can be harbored in dirt, they are going to be more prone to intestinal tract parasites, especially roundworms and hookworms would be the big ones.
And John has another question. Are homeopathic eye drops safe for dogs? Do you recommend them?
I don't know what would be in the homeopathic eye drops. I'd have to know what the actual ingredients are. It really is going to depend on what the reason is you're treating a dog's eye problem. If we have something like a corneal ulcer, we would want to avoid anything that's going to have steroids or kind of anti-inflammatory properties because that can make the ulcer worse. If it's something like a bacterial infection, most likely you're going to be needing an antibacterial eye drop, and I don't think a homeopathic eye drop would be helpful for that. If it's just to, you know, clean your dog's eyes because they've been out running in a field, it may be perfectly fine to just use something very benign. But I'd really have to know exactly what's in it and what the reason is you're treating the eyes because not all eye drops are created equal.
Jeanette in La Crosse, Wisconsin, you are next. Hi, Jeanette. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. Just a quick comment. I just recently found out because I was babysitting a cat that our local Humane Society, I don't know if it's everywhere, they'll put those soft paws on your cat for only $5.
Wow, that's a great idea. Soft paws are these little plastic nail caps that can go on that will help prevent your cat from causing damage to the house and scratching. But the big problem with them is they don't stay on all the time. They are going to fall off. Remember the way cats' nails grow, they grow kind of in layers, and you can have them stay on for a month. They may fall off the next day. And so having a kit at home and learning how to do it yourself is one way to be able to make sure that those stay on and that your cat will not cause damage to, you know, your furniture or your flesh.
Yeah.
And my question really was, don't get mad at me, but what do you think about debarking a dog?
I am totally against it for a couple of reasons. One, the only way you can debark them is to remove their vocal cords or do a tie back. And that opens up their airway. Those vocal cords are there not only to produce voice, but also to block access to water and food and things getting down the windpipe. And we can they may run into issues with aspiration pneumonia. And so that would be a horrible thing for a dog to go under. So I'd rather work with trying to find out why the dog is barking and try to come to a solution for that, or consider using something like the citronella bark collar or one of the humane electronic bark collars if necessary. So I think there's other things that we can do rather than surgery, which could be life-threatening.
Mm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lots of callers online here. Pat and Nina, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I used to be a pet sitter in Madison. In fact, one of your pet sitters, Larry, is the one who drafted me. And I would not see a cat unless I could see them twice a day. And I always stayed till I could actually see the cat because, you know, they could get locked in a drawer or the dryer or something. And one time, and I always counted their pee. Mm-hmm. Because one time I noticed that one of the cats I was watching hadn't peed as many times as he normally did in his pee box.
And there you go. And that, you know, this is why I recommend that if you are going to be looking for a pet sitter, ideally hiring someone that is a professional pet sitter. And we do have here in the Madison area. I just spoke with them a couple of months ago, a wonderful association of professional pet sitters.
Yes, and I was a member of them, and we gave each other ideas about those kinds of things. And professional pet sitting is really important. I live now in Nina, and people normally hire their teenager friend, and they'll give them like a box of stationery for taking care of the animal. And you know, and the person comes in, they clean out the box, they throw some food in, and they go. And I've had a cat that knew how to work the childproof things. He couldn't do them because they were too strong, but he knew how they worked. And he got one of the doors open enough, and he got in there with the food, and he was stuck. So, And when he came out, it was sort of like, darn.
It's, you know, and especially for dogs, they need a lot of interaction as well. And unless you've got a dog door that the dog can go in and out, they have to potty outside frequently. So,
yeah, there we go. And Pat, thanks a lot. Carmen and Gretchen are the two professional cat sitters that I've had and have done an absolutely marvelous job. Well, we have to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we will be back with Dr. Sandy. You stay with us. You may be surprised to know that animals can suffer from seasonal allergies, just like I do, maybe just like you do as well. And, you know, it's important to know the options for their best care. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. She takes time every month to spend with us and offer advice on a variety of things. And seasonal allergies, one of them, can pets get shots to help with seasonal allergies?
You can. I mean, you can do allergy testing to find out what they are allergic to, but a newer technique is sublingual drops. So people that are a little needle phobic, they may want to consider this other mode of treatment that just involves giving them some drops under their tongue, kind of put a little thing in the corner of their mouth, and that seems to work. But one of the things that we sometimes don't consider is that if an animal needs to be vaccinated for its regular, you know, vaccines like rabies, distemper, and so on, should you be doing it when they're in the middle of allergy season? And this was a study that was done out of Canada, and they talked about that vaccinations, the schedule, you may want to consider altering it to a different time of the year when the dog isn't allergic, because it seems that when you introduce some of that foreign material into the animal, it may worsen allergies and allergy season. So just a thought out there, just something that I read, and I thought, no, you know, it's not something I usually consider. If I've got an allergic dog in, should we be, you know, delaying or, you know, doing vaccines a little bit earlier so they're done in the winter when the dog may be less allergic?
Oh, good. Very, very good points. Jackie in Milwaukee has a question for you, and so let's go to her. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning, Larry. Glad you had your trip. I've got a controversial question. I'm 86.
Mm.
The dog I have is 9. I've tried to socialize him, but because of his breed, he is a chow.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to think about what's going to happen to him. There he goes.
Yep.
What's going to happen to him if I would die or be institutionalized? I'm having contests with people. My son is agreeable, but I don't feel that chows can be rehomed with any kind of success.
Well,
I'd like to have your opinion. I know it's a hard one, but...
Yeah, I think any dog can potentially be rehomed. Where it becomes a difficult problem is if the dog comes with baggage. If, you know, I'll give you an example. We had an elderly client that the family, she had an old retired greyhound who passed away, and the family decided they were going to get her a puppy, and they adopted her a German Shepherd puppy for her. And she ended up with torn skin and, you know, lots of issues because she was frail, was unable to take the dog out for walks. And so the dog just had the basement exercise in, was very poorly housebroken, not socialized because she couldn't take it to dog training class. Family members, even though they got her the dog, were not interested in helping her with this. And as a result, by the time the dog was 2 years old, totally antisocial, very difficult situation to have that dog be put into another home because it's not impossible, but it's going to take a very special person that's going to be able to work with that dog and try to gain back some of that important time that it lost when it was young. So I don't know what kind of issues your dog has, if it's social with people, if it likes other dogs. I would be looking at, you know, contacting maybe a chow rescue group so that you've got them in your back pocket and your family members know how to reach them, because a lot of the rescue groups will be able to foster these dogs in situations and then hopefully find them a forever home after that. But if
the rescue groups are still telling me, including a breeder, these dogs are not rehomable.
Oh.
Well, I have to disagree with that. And I think it may be, you know, talking to your local shelter, making sure this is something that is all laid out in your will so that the care for your dog can be, you know, be handled financially until a new home can be found. I mean, I don't want to say end the dog's life because I don't know your dog well enough, and I think that it's, you know, every dog has that opportunity and possibility of finding a forever home if you can find the right person. But this is the time you need to be looking into it.
Very, very difficult. Well, good luck with it, Jackie. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I hope you are able to work this out. Kyle in Milwaukee has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Kyle.
Yes, I have 2 dogs. I've got basically a Chihuahua that's probably 12 years old. Chihuahua is about 12, and I have a Chihuahua mix that's probably about 9. And they're both rescues, and I've had them for about 8 years. And out of the blue, the younger one, that the mix that happens to be older also, excuse me, that happens to be bigger by about 5 pounds,
mm-hmm,
has suddenly become unbelievably aggressive towards the older, smaller one. And the pecking order before was the older one became the more dominant one. And then out of the blue, we were taking a car ride. They have free rein in the back seat. We get home, the small one hops up on the couch. The big one goes over and just starts attacking her, and it's been that way ever since.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. These are such tough situations to take care of because we do sometimes see changes like this when we've got a dog that either has a health issue or age-related issues that the other dog can say, hey, now I can be the top dog in the household. I would, at this point, because when we see dog fighting, it can be extremely severe. I actually adopted a dog that came in to be euthanized because she was a little Yorkie named Electra. I don't currently have her because she's passed away from heart disease, but she killed and partially consumed her housemate. It was, and so when we see fighting, it's usually worse between females. And it, you know, there may be some age component as well. Physical differences can sometimes make a difference as well, but keep them totally separated behind baby gates and so on to prevent serious injuries, and start working with an applied animal behaviorist that it can, you know, help you with seeing things that you may be doing that may actually be driving this as well. There's kind of two schools of thoughts when we're dealing with this. Is one is that both of them are, you know, subordinate to you. They both have to wait for everything. They both have to, you know, they're not up on the furniture. They defer to you to get what they want, the best things out of life. And by deferring, that's, you know, they get everything that they want. The other is to support the younger dog in its quest to be the top dog, and it gets fed first, greeted first, gets up on the sofa, and the older dog is now well-loved but not allowed on the furniture. You know, it doesn't get petted first, gets fed second, and sometimes that's another way of helping. But this would be something you really need some a professional help with.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. And Lance in Oregon, it's your turn. Hi, Lance.
Good morning. Thank you for my call.
Sure.
The question I have is, we had a Labrador, which we lived in Arizona for about 7 years of the dog's life, and moved up here to Wisconsin. We did not treat the dog down there for flea and tick because of the dry weather and so forth. However, we started treatment up here. Sometime thereafter, our dog was developing seizures. Not big ones, but every once in a while would have a seizure. We asked the vet, and the vet did check him out several times and didn't know what was really the cause of it. However, the dog is gone because of some other issues. But I saw an ad in TV the other day for flea and tick treatment. And they said that we should discontinue it if it develops seizures. And I'm just wondering if that was the cause of our seizures in our dog.
Well, you know, it really depends on the product that you're using. The majority of flea and tick products, especially any of the products that you're going to be getting from your veterinarian, are going to be perfectly safe. And it may have just been coincidental that the dog had, you know, developed epilepsy for whatever reason, and it, you know, just happened to was up here while you were using the products. But there are some products, especially those that contain permethrins, which can be affect the nervous system if you're not using them at the right dose and applying them appropriately. And from the majority of those products are going to be some of the over-the-counter products, where you may not get the exact dose or the right dose. So I'd have to know what the product is. I would hope that this would be something that the veterinarian did send in an adverse drug reaction report. This is something that, as a veterinarian, when something comes up that is, you know, it occurs about the time that a medication is given, something, you know, strange happens, we like to know about it. And the only way we can do that is if things get reported. And so finding out what the product was and then maybe going in and looking at, you know, what adverse reactions have been reported for that particular product would be helpful. And then, you know, the other thing would be, you know, did you reapply it, and did the dog, you know, have a seizure shortly after reapplication? Well, then you've kind of, you know, maybe proven it. But sometimes seizures can be brought on through stress, and some of these topical products, dogs hate them and will go out and roll and get excited and be all anxious. And is that what was triggering the seizure? I don't know. I mean, so it comes down to, I really can't answer your question.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Lance. Appreciate it. And Joe in La Crosse, hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, I've got a cat that's 12 years old, and I've had him for about 2 years. And I was wondering if you could tell me what the difference between vomit and regurgitation is, because there's times when I think it's more like, I think it's regurgitation instead of vomit, because when he coughs up, you can still see some of the dry food pellets, and it's not really liquidy, and there's also, I'm going to guess, there's a softer stuff in there, too. It's probably coming from the canned food.
Yeah, there's what the difference is vomiting is an active activity that the pet or humans or whatever goes through, where your abdominal muscles are going to contract. You usually anticipate that it's going to happen. You start to get nauseous, and the body's normal response is to close down your windpipe so that you don't inhale anything. And it does, involve usually some, nausea, and then that abdominal press and up it comes. Regurgitation is passive. And what this usually involves is where we have the esophagus is not working to push the food down into the stomach. So it's just kind of either sitting there, or you've got something like a hiatal hernia that is, keeping some of the stomach contents up into the chest cavity, and then the animal lays in a certain position, stands up, puts their head down, and then all of a sudden, boom, stuff just pours out of their esophagus. And so it's very passive. There's no gagging or anything else before it. And the problem with that is, because it's so passive, the animals don't close down their windpipe, and they're prone to aspiration pneumonia. They may inhale some of that esophageal or stomach contents up, down into the airway. So that it can be a life-threatening problem. So to say whether your cat is regurgitating or vomiting, I'd almost have to see what it does before that food comes up. We've had an owner previously call about this, and boy, you can go to just changing the consistency of the food or changing the type of diet, ruling out metabolic problems or other organ-related problems that can cause chronic vomiting, scoping, biopsying, ultrasound, other imaging to, see if there's something wrong with your cat's stomach. But I think the first thing would be a visit to your veterinarian for a good physical exam, because sometimes that can even tell us why all of a sudden this 12-year-old cat has started vomiting.
Good point.
Or regurgitating. I don't know which one it is. But if you get it on video, that's very helpful. Yeah.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We had some Facebook comments. Ellen, by the way, Ann called to share that she adopted a chow. Remember earlier we had the call about chow dogs. And she said she adopted a chow. The dog was was aggressive at first, but came to be a wonderful pet. So chows definitely are adoptable.
Right. And why the breeders are saying they're not, or the rescue group, which is is their goal, unless they personally know this dog, that it may not be an easy, rehoming, I don't know. But I think, yes, every dog has that potential for finding a forever home.
Ellen from Wausau has a 9-year-old Maltese dog with nasal discharge, a vet treated sinus infection, but then infection, it came back. What would you recommend here?
A few things. Number one, we don't see nasal infections in dogs very often. And often when we see them, it's because there's some other underlying cause, like a tooth-root abscess that's up into the nose, which being a 9-year-old Maltese definitely could be. A foreign body, maybe my Yorkie that I mentioned earlier, actually inhaled a piece of grass and had it up her nose, and she was having chronic nasal discharge, and we had to go up and find it and get it flushed out. Tumors and things could be causing it as well. And so, we start with the easy things like your veterinarian did, and then start looking at, maybe we need to get some imaging done, like a CT scan of the skull, so we can look in those nasal passages and sinuses, rhinoscopy, going up and having a look and getting biopsies or cultures, samples done would be probably the next step for this little dog.
Let's turn to Chuck in Wisconsin Rapids next. Chuck, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 6-year-old standard poodle who was just recently diagnosed with blastoplasmosis.
Mm-hmm.
And she's currently on medication for it. And I'm just wondering what the prognosis is for blastoplasmosis. She seems to be, the only thing, sign she's been showing is swollen lymph nodes. She's fatigued all the time, and that's not her at all. And she has somewhat of a noticeable limp on her rear leg.
Okay,
I'm just wondering about the prognosis.
Yeah, most dogs with blasto with appropriate long-term treatment are going to do well.
And what is it again?
Blastomycosis is a fungus that lives in the soil that, of course, you know, dogs are, you know, putting their nose down to the ground can be exposed to. And it's not just dogs, it's people as well can pick this up. It may present with either skin sores, it may be in the lungs. There's a lot of different presentations. Sometimes we'll even see it in the eye itself.
I had it in the lungs.
You had it in the lungs, yeah. And for many dogs, they do quite well. They're going to be needing, you know, lots of checks in and out of the veterinarian. It's not inexpensive to treat, but it usually has a good outcome with the appropriate treatment and management.
Okay, so
thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot. And someone else had the same question, Liz, on Facebook. Is there some sort of Are there stages to blasto?
There are. I mean, we can see some cases where if the lungs are really bad on radiographs, we would have to be, you know, quite careful with watching these dogs while they're on therapy, because you can set up an inflammatory response as you're killing off the organisms, and that could be make things worse. So some of these dogs do have to be in critical care in the first stages of treatment, and may need to be watched very, very carefully.
I want to go back to allergies for a minute, because I'm not sure we talked about various things relating to shots and so forth, but are there other options that
about? Antihistamines may or may not help dogs. You know, we know that they have other allergy mediators, but Benadryl, Claritin, that type of thing may help take the edge off. I think one of the big things we need to do is make sure that when the dog comes in from outside, that we wash their feet, their underside, and so on, because they're going to be bringing molds and pollens and things inside. Wash your dog bedding more frequently as well. Use a HEPA filter vacuum. Keep your windows shut and make sure that you've got air conditioning on. Again, that's going to help keep the outdoors from coming in as well. Do your homework ahead of time. You know, this is something that we know can have a strong genetic component. And so if it's not something you want to be prepared for, you may want to be, you know, really being selective as to what breed of dog you get. Golden retrievers, Labrador retrievers, by far they're probably in any of like the Westies and things, as some of the small terriers are like poster children for developing allergies. And so, you know, trying to get a dog that maybe, before you even think about adopting, that may have a healthier skin. Treating secondary infections, and that means more frequent bathing, may be helpful as well. And then we start getting into some of the other bigger drugs that are going to help stop some of the immune reaction that's going on. Unfortunately, the drug that works the best and has the fewest side effects, one called Apoquil, is in very, very short supply. And we still have about 14 dogs on our waiting list right now, and many more that would want to be on it. As soon as the drug comes in, usually within an hour, it's out of the pharmacy. So very, very short supply, and it doesn't look like it's going to be ending anytime
soon.
Now,
why would it be? Is it just that difficult to make?
It's difficult to make. Like they're having a hard time with the large dog size, keeping it from crumbling, and so getting the right consistency, just not having a facility that was geared up for the demand. When one of the first medications that we've had that doesn't cause dogs to drink more, urinate more, really suppress their immune system, but blocks the itching and is safe, boy, I mean, I would stand in line for that particular drug as well. But it's too bad. It's been on the market now for about a year and a half, and we're still trying to do catch up to, you know, so we've got enough to treat the dogs that are currently on it, but no new patients.
Well, I'm looking back at our Facebook page, again, the title of the page, The Larry Mueller Show title, and Holly sent a photo of Shotzi, the Pomeranian, helping pull weeds. Now, if that isn't a cute
photo. And especially with the weed that's there, it's garlic mustard, and we know that that's an invasive one, and we don't want that there. But, you know, you really have to know your plants in your backyard, because, you know, there may be plants back there, especially like with cats and lilies. You don't want them chewing on those.
No.
And even the kind of mulch you use, cocoa bean mulch, very toxic for dogs. Enough residual active ingredient in the cocoa that can make a dog chocolate toxic. So it may look nice and smell nice, but don't use it in your yard. And even watch the pesticides and things you use, too. You have to be really careful.
And you are going to be back in about a month, and we'll do this all over again.
We will. We'll have another topic and, you know, maybe a few less cat questions and a few more dog questions. Who knows? It always varies.
Always varies. Thank you so much, Sandy. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Vet Medicine. She comes by once a month. And let's see, July 14th, I believe, second Tuesday of the month is when she comes. July 14th is that date. And, by the way, she recently got married. So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So she's newly married, newly minted here. Tomorrow, PJ Leash, who's been married a while, will join us to talk about the world of insects. In the meantime, boy, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for listening. And please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.